thank you for asking me to come and talk. You know, Ray Price's talk was very interesting because he elucidated something in his talk that I'm a firm believer in, that we need to move our discourse beyond just talking about emergency and essential surgery. And he's actually showing that you can do that. And he alluded to something. He had an insight that is germane to my talk, that he's actually able to return people to the workforce earlier. And that's something that I think is a very important insight. And I want to touch on that a little bit. And I think that, by the way, I'm going to talk about costing and economic valuation. And I think if you were to use some of these techniques to look at what he's doing, you would be very surprised at how effective and what that there's a huge economic benefit to doing this that is relatively unrecognized. So in terms of disclosures, I have none. In terms of acknowledgments, I have to really recognize the two collaborators that helped to develop the economic modeling technique. And also, when I talk about the cost analysis, it's really based on the work of Porter and Kaplan at Harvard Business School. So in terms of defining the problem, I guess the bottom line is that we do not have a toolkit that can allow us to really evaluate the economic impact and the cost of surgical care. And so that's the definition of the problem and where we're going from here. And in terms of the concepts that we're going to talk about, the first I'm going to touch on is economic analysis. The second is cost accounting. And really putting those together, that's the concept of return on investment. So what are you putting in financially and what are you getting back economically? Now, this slide just tells you the story very briefly about how I got into this. So a little over a decade ago, I was in business school and in accounting and finance classes, and we were discussing present value and discounted cash flow and how you value companies, and that all seemed very rational. And then I moved on with my career and started working with clinical researchers who had an MPH background, and they were talking about things that I really didn't understand. And I figured, well, I'm a plastic surgeon, and most of my textbooks have pictures, so maybe that's the problem. But I actually kind of lived with that for a while until I was talking to a donor. I was talking to a donor about investing in global surgery, and he was an investment banker. And I was telling him, well, 11% of Dally's this and Dally's that and Dally's whatever. And he stopped me and he said, you know what, John, I don't even know what a Dally is, and I quite frankly don't really care. If I am going to invest $2 million in surgery down in Haiti, what is my return on investment? I mean, he's an investment banker. That's the way he thinks. And so that's really where the light bulb went off, and I said, okay, I've got to do a little bit better. There's a certain segment of the population that I can't, we're not going to be able to talk Dally's to. So what's the next step? All right, how do we apply these types of concepts? So can we derive a present value for surgical interventions? I guess that's the problem. And what is the present value of the future economic impact? So, Ray has implemented laparoscopic procedures. What is the present value of the economic impact of doing that? All right, and where do we start? Well, don't just look at those two blue rectangles there. This is an economic analysis of a company. All right, and so what the accountants did is they looked at cash flows over the following years. They derived a present value, took out some of the debt, and said, okay, we're worth this much in present value terms. Here's how many shares we have. Therefore, that's our share value. So they looked at future cash flows, brought them into present value terms, and said, this is what our company's worth. We have these many shares. So bottom line is, can we do that? Now, I'm a cleft surgeon, so I said, can we do that type of thing with cleft surgery? Can we look at cleft incidents, derive cleft Dallys, and then can we turn those into dollars and say that that might be related to the economic impact of doing that? So our goal, take Dallys averted by cleft lip, for example, using two different approaches, and then I'll explain those in just a minute. Can we translate that into dollars using what's called a human capital approach or a value of a statistical life approach? So just a little background on the human capital approach. This assumes that we basically are only worth what we produce in a given year. So saying that, if you're out of work for 1 year, it's GNI per capita. A lot of economists don't like this. They feel like it undervalues human life and it undervalues the agency effect that we have on our families and just on the community. Now, the other way to look at this, Thomas Schelling came up with something called the value of statistical life. Very exciting. You can see how excited he was about the concept. And you know, this is based on really 50 years of good, solid economic literature based on what human beings are willing to pay to reduce their risk. So you kind of back calculate the, quote, value of a statistical life by looking at, you can look at it two different ways. You can look at labor costs, for example, and say, what are people demanding in the labor force for jobs that which are more risky? Or you can just quite frankly ask people. So there are economic surveys that say, okay, if I can reduce your risk of mortality by 1 in 1,000, how much will you pay for that? All right, one is called revealed preference, one is called stated preference. Those are the two techniques. So bottom line, and there's some opaque math that goes behind this, and I have it in the appendix if anyone wants to look at it with me after the talk. Bottom line is, if you use a human capital approach and you look at sub-Saharan Africa and say, theoretically, what is the present value of cleft lip and palate repair in sub-Saharan Africa, using the human capital, you get about $425 million. And if you use that VSL technique, you get about $5.3 billion. And I'll tell you, that's on the low end because we discounted and age-weighted our DALYs. So if you don't discount and age-weight your DALYs, you're going to get numbers which seem just incredibly high. So you see, you get a range there. All right, so hold that in a thought bubble off to the side for a minute. That's economic valuation. Now I want to talk about costing. And I won't bore you with this. I'm going to do it in three slides, believe it or not. They have whole courses on it at Harvard Business School, and I'm going to do it in three slides. So just start at the bottom here with me. This is a process map. If any of you were at Kiran Agrawal Harding's talk earlier today on femur fracture, he alluded to this. This is a process map, and you march through what the patient does through their course of care. So if I'm the patient and I see Ray Price for 5 minutes, and then I see you for 10 minutes, and then I see you for 15 minutes, you march through everything they do, and you put a cost to that, all right, based on what the cost of that provider is. And you build the costs, you know, all the costs that go into care get built into the interactions that you have with the various people. So we did that, and you can see we came up with a number. Here's MD cost, RN cost, clinical assistant, ASR as a secretary. So we marched through that in our own hospital. This is in Boston, actually. And what we did is we looked at three different diagnoses. So we looked at things that I take care of. So nevus on the left, you resect that in the operating room. Plagiocephaly, those are kids with flat heads, and you put a helmet on them. And the other one on the right there, those are the kids with head problems that you do more than put a helmet on. You have to take them to the operating room. But when they come into my clinic, believe it or not, a lot of them look to cost the same because they're the same E&M code very often. And for those of you who understand the RVU system, E&M coding, it doesn't really do a good job of adequately describing what we do. So we said, you know, a ratio of cost to charge using RVUs is not a good way of costing. Let's apply time-driven activity-based costing to what we're doing. And what we showed is relatively intuitive. We basically demonstrated that craniosynostosis kids, they're more complicated. The plagiocephaly kids are less. And I looked at this. I'll tell you a funny story. I was, as chief of the department, I thought, these plagiocephaly kids, we should maybe push these back to the primary care offices because they aren't a surgical case necessarily. My CFO came to me and showed me this, and I said, hey, let's hold on a second. Let's not send those back right away because, you know, the revenue on these in the present system until we go to a bundled system is actually quite positive. So what we did is we re-engineered the process. We're using mid-level providers, and we're actually, you know, improving the efficiency of our system. But that's a different issue. So in conclusion, what I'd like to allude to or explain is that the things we're talking about here are very important. Burden, access, outcomes, I don't want to say that those aren't important, but I think we need to do a little bit more. We need to look at the cost of providing care and what the impact of that care is, what the potential economic impact is. I still think we need to do these things, but we need to do cost and economic analysis. That the finances behind things drive policy decision, and they also drive donor decisions. Surgery is a good financial investment, but I would also want to say that I do not want to use this data to say that you should, you know, start vertical interventions. I'm not trying to say that, you know, cleft vertical interventions are the answer. I think that you need to do these things within a properly functioning horizontal health system. My point, though, is that they are actually beneficial from an economic and a cost standpoint. And then in order to do this properly, you have to look at both the numerator and the denominator, so you have to look at the impact and the cost. It doesn't help to just look at one. And the other thing I'll bring out that's an educational issue that you know, I can tell you from my own training, I wasn't really trained to do this as a surgical resident or going through medical school. So we need to look at how we're training healthcare providers so that we have the skill set that will allow us to analyze things in a different way. So, thank you.
Thank you, John. I think that the economic impact of having surgical care is really something that we should always be thinking about. So we have succeeded in actually creating time for questions. So I would like to just open the floor for questions, and hopefully we'll have a good discussion. And also please introduce yourself. Thank you for that question.
Well, you know, in terms of the skill set issue, there's no easy answer. I think we need to build that into education at the medical school and at the residency level. It's going to take a while. It's not something that you do overnight. But, you know, I'm seeing a change even in my trainees, actually, who want both more global health exposure and also more exposure to, you know, business methodology, economy methodology. So I'm seeing trainees who are more interested in that, but I don't have an easy answer to this issue of training or changing the training paradigm.
It's interesting because we're going to talk tomorrow at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, and I'm going to ask the question is, well, what's preventing, if you believe that surgery truly is a necessary component of basic health care, if the World Health Organization says that everybody is entitled to the highest level of health care, to have that highest level, surgery needs to be involved in there if we're going to attack the serious problems that are facing us over the next century, because we have non-communicable diseases that are becoming a major problem. So if we believe that, we have to begin to ask, okay, so what are those problems? And so we've asked a lot of the questions as to, okay, well, we know there's low human resources, there's low physical resources, there's all sorts of things that are problems. We have physicians that we train them in Uganda and they go to another country. We have a flight of all of our trained people. How do we keep them when we train them in those environments? And one of the things that from Mongolia, the project I just talked about was just a 10-year project, which is been slow in coming. But it's the Mongolians there that have shown me that it's not just getting a procedure, it's building the healthcare infrastructure that supports everything in general. It's building an infrastructure and finding a business model that's going to support that in the different environments. That business model is going to be different than it is in the U.S., hopefully, because we're struggling here. Finding the infrastructure to be able to support it. I mean, the World Bank recommended that there should be a $30 billion investment for building private health care in sub-Saharan Africa rather than just building public health care. I was at a meeting at the World Bank and they brought in ministers of health from the different countries and rolled out their recommendations. So I think that there's going to be a broader view as to how do we build sustainable health care. It has to be things that, if you just train people in basic surgery, I mean, there has to be a component of training essential surgical care with people who may not be fully trained surgeons or fully trained medical doctors. We have the same system in the United States. We have PAs and nurse practitioners and and a big growth in that type of healthcare model. But there has to be, if we're going to maintain professors in medicine and surgery, they're not going to stay unless they have the equipment, the supplies, the infrastructure that allows them to provide modern healthcare for their people. And that's what we found in Mongolia. That was one of the goals, was can we set up infrastructure in four regional areas of the hospital and train them to do higher level surgery? Would that be something that would keep them in those facilities rather than going to the capital or somewhere else? And so far in 10 years, everybody we have trained in those rural areas are still there. A lot of other reasons for that. But I think it's multifactorial, but I think we have to look at what John was just talking about. What is the, if we can come up with the financial example of how it's going to improve the economies, I think we'll have better support from governments, funders, and although Sam mentioned there's a fixed amount of money for healthcare, I actually think there's probably another source of funding that we haven't tackled, that there'll be people that are interested in that we can find more funding if we can present it to people in a different manner.
Yes. And I have a follow-up question to that. Can you elucidate what you mean by social impact? What are the measurements, are the metrics that you're looking at, or they're looking at? Thank you for that.
It would probably be nice to have dollar figures, but then also some of those subjective things that go along with it.
Right. You look at return on investment, and investment bankers might be looking at 20 times return for a dollar invested. So that's not the surgery, that is a much better impact.
Yeah. Thank you for that. I saw someone at the back. Yes. Please introduce yourself.
So, the bottom conviction is to be in the slide.
Thank you. Well, I would suggest to Dr. Mira to answer 1 and 3. I would suggest answering 1 and 3 and for Dr. Price, question number 2.
Well, so your last question there, I guess it's too early in our use of this methodology. We haven't really deployed this or gone to a government and said, you know, here's your return on investment. I think I would love for, you know, people in the audience to play around with some of these techniques and see how accurate they are. I don't know that we can. Part of it is dependent, I will say, on the limitations of the DALI. So, you have to be fair and say, if there's not a disability weight for certain things, we can't crunch the numbers on it. So, I only have 15 minutes to show you, but there are some limitations. You can't bring me any diagnosis, and I can't just take 15 minutes and churn out a number. So, I guess it's early on. I think this is an important concept. I think that it's something that we should continue to work on. And as I said, the reason that I'm trying to talk about this in a number of different areas is I'm hoping people a lot smarter than me will look at the things we're doing and maybe improve it, and then it can be deployed. What was the question?
I misheard.
I'm feeling like maybe we should reconsider the main theme of this panel. Is more.
Go for it.
How can we sort of use what data is available, what structures are out there to ask these more critical questions? So the 2013 projections, this is a very boring answer, actually. We just took the average of births from the preceding January to September and then projected that out to the end of the year. So very simple, but just to tell you a little more interesting, kind of trying to haggle with how we could do these analyses. Another type of analysis that we did, another permutation, was to take 2007 census data and try and match that to the communities that the women were saying that they had come from, and then take the district-specific growth rate and apply that, and then to get the sense of growth, you know, people dying, moving in and out of the communities, and then apply an approximate 4.5% to get a sense of sort of live births. And then see how that coverage would go in terms of institutional deliveries, coverage of total expected possible deliveries in the community. So actually the slide that I uploaded on Wednesday when we had the deadline was that. And then we actually thought about it more and realized that there's such subjectivity in the concept of home. So women are listing where they're from, and they're describing communities that are much larger than what the census is reflecting. And it was skewing all of our numbers. So we decided actually we wanted to just take it back to more simple. What can we think about in terms of percent increase? But I guess this exploration, trying to think of how we can support our implementing staff to ask these questions is really around this. You know, they came up with a great way of thinking with available data. It was maybe a little further than we could go just because of these constraints. But like I said, this conversation is, for all of us, I think, quite exciting to see that we're collaborating in this way to ask these hard questions.
So actually, very interesting question, because in doing any kind of work, there's always politics that goes on behind everything. And you have to be very careful. I think one of the smartest things that we did when we were asked to come help teach was to make sure that we maintained that relationship, that we were there to help do what they wanted us to do. Now, that we did form the courses together in collaboration. They weren't quite sure exactly what it meant to come teach laparoscopy, and we suggested various things and kind of developed things from our side to their side that became a combined collaborative process. But I think very smartly we said, look, Dr. Segerlin is the one who is coordinating this. And because we did have all of a sudden then politicians from all the different little IMOGs come say, well, we want you to come teach it in our hospital. We want this in our place, especially as we're bringing equipment initially. But we have transitioned from bringing equipment to now just primarily education. So for laparoscopy now, it's taking off that all these other different hospitals are funding and buying their own equipment and are now asking for the training to come. And we're still coordinating that through Dr. Segerlin, saying, well, where do you see the next important spot is for us to do this? And at this point, is it important for us or their teams? Because now their teams are going out providing education for some of these other facilities, and that's been our goal, is to get rid of the outside influence and let them continue to do it. So we transitioned recently now in in building their capability of expanding their residency program in surgery, where their residency was 1.5 years in surgery. It's now down to 2 years. Now it has some mandatory laparoscopic experience. I just met with the WHO, and they're recommending expanding their surgical residency to 4 years, and they're working on how they financially can do that. And so I think it's a combination of, I think we kept it under control because we let the local people be the ones that directed where. I mean, we had some input, but whenever I got the questions, would you come here? It's like, we need to ask Dr. Segerlin. Let's see what she thinks is best for the country, and she would then help us keep that under control. So I find that the local support and the local direction is extremely important.
Sam.
Specifically identified, and I think very astutely, is
Me? Well, I would say that definitely there is a role for telemedicine in improving skills, and that's already happening. We have certain countries like Japan who has established a very robust laparoscopic surgical skills training program that they've actually expanded to the neighboring Asian countries, and they are providing that kind of expertise and help. And the question now is, how can we take this type of technology and prove that it actually improves outcomes in terms of increased skill, morbidity, mortality, and the length of the surgical training required, before you can actually be deployed to a district hospital and start working almost immediately. And those numbers haven't really been studied and looked at on a global basis, enough even to reach, obviously, the WHO, who is a perfect conduit to developing countries. But definitely there are a lot of programs, NGOs, universities who are exploring that as an option. And Ray can also give a good answer.
I think this is a real area for growth and areas that can really help not only developing countries, but our own country. Anywhere from point of care laboratory testing on an iPhone with a drop of blood to be able to give you right at point of care with your laboratory testing. Wouldn't that be neat to have in our own hospitals that you go with a drop of blood that then it sends into the system that's available for everybody? Well, that is really close to market with some groups that are working on things right now. Out into the rural areas of Uganda, to be able to have that kind of capability that could even load up to a cloud medical record somewhere that could be accessed by people throughout the country might be a very interesting model. The ability to be able to look for pathology specimens is already happening in many areas. I know that a private hospital in Mongolia contracts with a group that's in L.A., they do in 20 minutes can have a pathology report on what they've done. And so I think that there is a role for that for a period of time. But I think we also have to be careful. I mean, what is the healthcare model we want to have 100 years from now? Is that going to be a worldwide healthcare model that we're accessing, still from Nigeria? The healthcare company that got the award for the best healthcare company in the country just a couple years ago was on their website advertises that we send people from Nigeria to India to get their health care. Is that the model that we want? There's a company that's building a whole new hospital down in the Cayman Islands to cater to American health care, where they can provide health care much cheaper. So I think it'll be a very important model that we can use to build health care worldwide. But I think there will always be a need that people want to get good health care in their local environment. And that's even in rural United States. When you talk to people, well, they want to go up to the big Huntsman Cancer Institute in Salt Lake City to get their breast cancer taken care of. Many of them want to stay in their local, small, rural area because that's where family is who can take care of them. And that's, I think, a universal kind of finding as well. So I think we need to build up both areas.
I just have one comment on a related topic, or on a different topic. There's another slide of Ray's that caught my attention giving his talk, and that was when he was showing the difference in the number of days that people are in the hospital open versus laparoscopic. And then Sam had made a comment in his prior talk about how ministries of health kind of view their budget as a fixed budget, and then Ray alluded to that. And I think the flaw in thinking like that is that you actually can expand the pie by doing what Ray has done, in the sense that now you have a situation where instead of a patient being in the hospital for 8 days, they're only in there for two. You have an economic benefit for the patient treated. You can also put more patients in those beds because that patient has then left. You have economic benefit for those patients who are being treated. You know, you probably didn't hire new nurses because your staffing complement is probably relatively fixed. So in a way, you can expand your pie by doing some of the things that Ray has just shown. And I think that, again, just speaks to the need that if you sit down and you can crunch through the numbers on, there's a little bit of excess cost, capital cost and things like that. But if you crunch through those numbers and then show what not only the impact would be for the patients that you treated, but those new patients that you can treat. And actually following up on Sam's question, obviously it gets tricky when you go from country to country, but when you're within a country, if you're talking about economic benefit, for example, as long as you're staying within that country, you're at least comparing apples with apples. So you're looking at patients who used to be in there a day, now you're treating more patients. You
And I just wanted to also add, in terms of, you know, the question on transferring technology and skill, you know, robotic surgery potentially becoming cheaper and being transferred. And I would just caution against thinking about appropriate technology in developing countries. I have a slide that showed that surgical care is completely different in developing countries, so we can't really cookie cutter, you know, what worked here may not work in other countries. So the Lancet has run a whole series about appropriate technology in medicine, and they found an alarming amount of medical devices that are actually deployed to developing countries but are largely unused. So again, you know, maybe the innovation may come from developing countries themselves, you know, seeking to really solve their own problems, taking the principles, then translating it to what will work for them. So we should be careful about always thinking that what's West or high income is always best. So. Claire, I have a question for you. Oh, sorry. Oh, yes. To answer that last point, there's a paper that was published in 2008 by Tom Weiser, and I referred to that study before, where he actually quantified the number of surgical procedures that are being done globally, and, you know, using the best available data. And he found that as GDP of countries go up, the number of surgical procedures also went up. So, I mean, and we are talking we've been talking about economics, and, you know, and it's always, you know, because surgery is so resource intensive, it's, you know, money will always be a critical part of it. And you can't not talk about money in the economics. Sorry. In Mozambique.
Yeah, well, certainly the traditional birth attendance is a hot topic itself, whether to engage them or not. And lots of ministries of health have shied away from that. I think Pathfinder takes the approach that they're an existing asset in the community, and so long as they're there and so long as distance and transportation is an issue, and we know from Janani Suraksha Yojana in India that they did start an incentive program to bring women into the hospitals, but they started the policy before hospitals really had the capacity to meet that demand. Women were giving birth on the sidewalks outside of the hospital. Not a good example of building trust with the community. So in the meantime, when women still are giving birth in communities and traditional birth attendants are there, can we work with them? We try to do that. But I think this is actually maybe getting back to the original theme of our panel in terms of community-based strategies. So we try to work a lot in this. We talk about at Pathfinder this zone of interaction between community systems and health systems, how we can work in inside of the function areas in the zone of interaction to maximize health outcomes, basically, for communities. And one of the sort of interventions, let's call it innovations, that we have is these facility community co-management committees. And it's really an opportunity, we keep seeing it coming up in our program, it's so useful, to bring communities together, community leaders, but also just community members, with facility staff and with district planners, those kinds of people, so that they can talk together about how, either at the facility level or the district level, performance is going in terms of meeting health needs that are identified by the community. This also creates a space, really, for community members and health facilities, but maybe in this instance with traditional birth attendants, mostly community members, to hold stakeholders at the local level accountable for problems. So if a TBA turns into a quack doctor who's giving shots of people are dying, and there's a conversation happening in that community, and they're identifying in real time, then we don't need to look to policy or law to stop that TBA. There's a lot of pressure that communities can act and place on traditional birth attendants themselves. So when we talk about community system strengthening, that's really what we're thinking about. How can we build structures that are meaningful for communities to hold whomever accountable for the health outcomes they want to see? And we think that that's a sustainable answer. I don't have the costing for it. But it doesn't cost very much.
We'll have to collaborate on that. Is still the main topic. Is it the community-based? I mean, the community that I was talking about is a larger community than a local community in one area. Yet that local community has had a dramatic, the community of healthcare providers in Mongolia has now had a huge, dramatic impact on that local community. And part of it, this program in Mongolia was the doctors came and said, patients don't understand the benefit they can receive from this. When we first started teaching this in 2005, people say, I want my doctor to open me up and put my hands in there and feel. I don't want to go through that little laparoscopic thing. And we were told that we needed to go on national television to educate the population about the benefits that they could receive. And at first I thought it was people trying to build up their own businesses, but it's a national healthcare system. That wasn't what they were doing. So we were able to go on and do national call-in talk shows and participate in scientific TV shows and things and interviews to help educate the public about what the benefit is, to show patients and how they're doing, and even some filming of what we were doing. That has now changed so that in many hospitals, 80% of gallbladders are being removed laparoscopically now as of our last trip. And so it still is it's a community. And when we say, well, it's expensive, if we say we need it, well, how can we make it less expensive? And so just like so many other things, with an ophthalmological program that they redesigned the lens, so it costs just $4 for a lens when they put in to treat a cataract. Same with so many areas in surgery. For a laparoscopic set, instead of a $60,000 set, can we engineer and make something that costs $500 or $1,500? We pose that as questions at the University of Utah. They have one that they think is just about ready to come out. There's one in Nebraska. There's a lot of places that are working on, well, look, if cost is the important concept, can we make it affordable? And I think that's part of the future for making surgery part of basic health care, is redesigning it, re-engineering it, and making it.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much for this very engaging panel session. I mean, if I might say so myself. Really combining community-based interventions, technology, and the economics of providing healthcare. And thank you very much for being an amazing audience as well.